It's my great pleasure and privilege to welcome our guest today in our Conversations with Legal Thinkers series. For those watching us out there, we have James Boyd White speaking with us today. I will address you as Jim, but would you say a few words of introduction about your career as a law teacher, your work as a law professor, as an academic?
Sure. You asked whether I define myself mainly as a law professor or a writer or a scholar or what. And I've actually been thinking about that a little. And I think what I am is a teacher and a writer in law and in the humanities. And I put them together because for me, my writing and my teaching are really very similar. Mm-hmm. That is, what I'm trying to do is not persuade people of the truth of some proposition or something like that, but to create an experience for the reader or an experience for the student, which will stimulate thought and imagination in a particularly productive way. One of the things that's true about both my writing and my reading is that I'm always interested in putting languages together. So this is one way of saying it, that's another way of saying it. This is one way of doing it, here's another way of doing it. And so I'm never just inhabiting one single way of thinking about law or something else. That makes sense?
Indeed. I wanted, in fact, to continue in that tone about the role of theory or of jurisprudence. You have never really written under the banner of theory or jurisprudence, yet my class is titled Jurisprudence and Critical Perspectives on Law. I do think, though, that your work has profound or deep theoretical implications. And I wanted to inquire a bit about your reluctance to use the term theory. Why is that? And why would you choose, or what other terms will you choose instead?
Well, one part of it is that my early experience of jurisprudence, for example, was a monoglot. It was the kind of philosophy that was done at Oxford and Harvard in those days, analytic philosophy. And that was the supreme language. And that's every question was to be stated in that way, and every answer was to be stated in that way. What we were talking about was this beautiful, wonderful string quartet called law. They're talking about it in these very reductive ways. And I think that's, I have a kind of allergy to be committing to a single language, as I say. And I think very often people do that very cheerfully. I mean, the sociologist says, what I'm going to do with law is tell you how it works sociologically in the world. You say, yeah, but that does nothing to tell me about what happens in the law court or in the lawyer's mind or what happens in this whole activity that I'm interested in. And the same thing would be true with a psychologist or an economist or something like that. They have their own dominant language, which they want to use to really obliterate what happens in law. And that doesn't mean, of course, there are a lot of people who are doing theoretical and especially critical work who aren't who don't present this problem. But that's just a sort of the history of my relationship with disquiet or something like that.
Yeah, in fact, my students have read your very short essay called Law as an Intellectual Activity, I talked to law and entering law students. And I wanted to ask you, if you had the chance now to address the new entry law class, what would you emphasize for them today?
I would emphasize the same thing as I always have. What I would say is that in law school, what you're doing is learning how to do something. And you don't know how to do it yet, and you're going to learn how to do it. And that kind of thing, what you're going to learn how to do is to think like a lawyer, which means to read like a lawyer and speak like a lawyer, with sensitivity to the various ways in which it has to be done in different cases and or different situations. And that's what we're going to be doing. And we're not going to be, and sometimes students resist and say, but isn't it true that the world is terrible? And you say, yes, the world is terrible. But what we're learning is how to use this language to make it better, really. I think that's what I'd say. You asked me before why I said intellectual pursuit. And what I'm answering there is, it used to be true, I think it probably still is true, that lots of kids come to law school thinking that what they're going to learn is a bunch of rules. And once they've learned the rules, this is what will separate them from ordinary people. And they'll be able to charge them for, say, here's this rule or that rule, and I know what it means. And that is an intellectual enterprise is worthless. That is what you think law school is. You're in for a big surprise. And so I'm trying to reduce the surprise by saying, actually, you're going to be challenged intellectually and imaginatively, mm-hmm. maybe like you've never been before.
I wanted to go a little bit back in time and talk about The Legal Imagination, your 1973 beautiful book, which jump-started the law and literature or the law and humanities movement. And I wanted to ask you whether you were at all surprised by the afterlife that the book has had.
Yeah, I was very surprised when the publisher said he wanted to publish a year edition of it. And I thought that was really quite an honor and so forth. And it's puzzling in another way, which is not obvious. The history of the book is that I was a student of literature, classical and English literature, and I loved it. And then I went to law school, and I loved doing law. And while I was in law school, I taught as a teacher in a humanities course at Harvard College. And I had just these two sides of my mind. And so I had this class, and the class was really a writing class for students. The question I'm putting to them is, you're learning to be a lawyer, which means you're going to talk law talk. And that, it's easy to imagine, would be deadly. And I can find you lots of examples which are deadly. And aren't you a little afraid of what's coming to you when you become, when you give yourself this education? And the answer was, yes, we are. And then the question is, how can you have this have a different ending? How can you write your way out of this kind of dead language in such a way and make law come alive? And in order to do that, you have to think about what other things are alive and good. And so that's where the literature comes in. And you say, well, if you can do this, why would you ever be a lawyer? And the idea is that in the course of the whole course, the student, and this really happened a lot, would they write themselves out of that problem? That is to say, they would learn, teach themselves, really, how to write and be in a lawyer's voice and with legal materials in ways that met their own criterion for good writing. And so that's what it was. It was very private. And the book is really just is a conversation between me and them and the reader of the book, the grown-up reader of the book, just overhearing this conversation, right? And I had one thought, which was, I shouldn't admit this, but I had one thought, which was, this is such an important and good thing, but a way of helping people adjust to law school and legal education. It should be taught all over the country. But of course, it hasn't been taught all over the country. And one of the reasons is nobody could really teach it the way I'm talking about, probably but me. And I began to realize that. And then it has had a character. I mean, people have read it and found it stimulating, and it has kept alive, I think, in good ways, in ways that I didn't really anticipate.
And there was someone, Mark Weisberg, who was teaching The Legal Imagination in Canada, in fact, for many, many years.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. Yeah, he was one of my most faithful users of that. The big thing about that book was that it was really addressed to the student's real situation, which is they're coming to law school, being excited by it and being anxious about it at the same time, and anxious about who they're going to become when they become lawyers and how are they going to think. And so this gave them an opportunity for thinking constructively about that in the context of, you know, William Shakespeare and Robert Frost and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Another landmark in your career, which came a bit later, was the publication of your book, When Words Lose Their Meaning. And there you developed what I would call a way of reading or a methodology of reading, which is at once ethical and political.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you generally about the impetus behind those ideas, or what was the motivation behind the book? What were you trying to accomplish with that book?
Well, when I finished The Legal Imagination, I said to myself, I'm never going to write another word. This has my entire education in it. That's nothing left to be said. But then I began thinking in terms of arguments and how they work in different contexts and the like. And I taught a course called Studies in Argument, in which we read some of these materials. And then I began to realize very slowly the different things that we read in that book could be put together and in a way that was mutually informative. What I discovered ultimately was that they did embody, all of them, a way of reading, and a way of reading which could be characterized by two main things. And one of them is that every one of them was written in a particular language, of course. But one question is, that raises the question, how are they going to respond to the inherited language they're using? Are they just going to use it in some stereotyped way? Or is it unsatisfactory in some way? Are they going to try and transform it? And how are they going to transform it? And every single one of them, of course, did transform the language and the sets of expectations that went with it. And so including the legal ones, as I said, this is really a part, this is a topic for legal discourse, just as it is for every other discourse. And the other side of it was that every text really makes or offers to make a kind of community with its reader. That is, they treat their reader insultingly, they treat them with respect, they treat them kindly, they inform them what they ought to know, all these different ways. And this means these can be bad or good, but they are all, in that sense, political and ethical creations, all of them. And that's built in my conversation with you right now, is an ethical, has an ethical element. Who are you and how am I treating you? How am I? Who are you treating me? And so we're creating a relationship. And that's true all along. So if you say something like the Iliad was entirely composed in a language that was designed to celebrate a particular heroic culture. And he used this poem, he used this language in a poem in such a way as to be critical of that culture. Say, wow, how does he do that? And then you look at Plato, you see the same thing's true. He has an inherited language of value and stuff like that from 5th century Greece, which is such a wonderful place. And for him, that's really not good. And he can't quite see why it's not good. And he invents, really, a social and intellectual form of dialogue in which the qualities and characteristics of their culture can be examined critically in the light of something that they're creating between them, which is approved and is thought to be good. And that would be true, really, of each one of the things that we read, Thucydides and Swift and Johnson, Jane Austen's novel, Edmund Burke's history, and then we close with the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the case of McCulloch against Maryland. And what I want to say is that what we're doing, what the people in all those cases are doing is of the same type or kind as all the other people we've been reading. And if you want to know how to do it well, create a Declaration of Independence well, you should be reading the Iliad and Plato and Thucydides and those people too. And that'll teach you how to do it well. So that was my idea about that.
I should confess that still my favorite book of yours is Justice as Translation, which for me transformed the way in which I understood judicial opinions and the act of judgment. But I wanted to ask you about the term translation and how is that you turn to the idea of translation to talk about the work of judges?
This is really a gift from a beloved friend of mine named Pete Becker, who died some years ago, but who was an anthropologist and linguist. When I came to Michigan, in fact, one of the reasons I came to Michigan once I met him was to want to work with him, and we did. We were part of a group that met frequently and stuff, and I learned a lot from him. And he was deeply embedded in translation. I was deeply embedded in language, and I learned from him, and I think he learned a little bit from me. And it turned out that the translation had what I'd been looking for in some way. I mean, every translation involves a distortion, every single one. Okay, you can't not distort. So now what distortions are you going to do? This is true of a translation from one language to another, from Czech to English, but it's also true of translations in the form of readings. You're reading an old case, you're reading an old statute that involves translating it and applying it in a new different context. And you're free to do that, but you've got to do it in a good way. And this is a little bit like the question I put to the students in the Legal Imagination, which is, how do you do this well? And by well, I mean not just well successfully and you win your cases. What I mean is ethically well. Do it in a way that makes you feel good for being the kind of person who can do this. That's the same in both cases. But I really just have a huge debt to my beloved friend Pete. No question about that. Mm-hmm.
So perhaps something that condenses your work is that you've been always opposed to an idea of impersonal or bureaucratic or abstract conceptions of law, and instead you have emphasized the idea of law being an art, and mostly an art of language, an art of the imagination. And why do you think it's important to stress these creative aspects or this creative dimension of law?
The danger is that people, both inside the law, but especially outside of the law, if they don't have any idea about this, are likely to think that the law is simply a set of rules or a set of results. And then they say, I don't like these results. These are bad results. So we should get rid of them. Mm-hmm. But that's not a very, and then someone else says, I like these results. These are good. We shouldn't get rid of them. Then they look each other in the eye and spit on the floor and have arm wrestling or something. But what law is a way of addressing this kind of conflict by elevating it so that you have people on both sides who are engaged in when it works well, in a highly intelligent, sophisticated argument, using a limited set of materials, which they have to use. This is the legal culture, bringing it into life in a new and fresh way. That is what it is. It's an art. And there are lots and lots of forces in the world that want to diminish or reduce other forms of life, but among them, law. This is true of the realists. They want to say, what's really going on is blah, 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 exercise of power. And I say, of course there's an exercise of power. No one would think anything else. But that's not what's really going on. What's really going on is these people where power is in question are functioning in this elegant, thoughtful, and ethically good way, and not only good way, a way in which justice is always the topic, stated or unstated. So that if you're an American lawyer and you're arguing to a judge, and he says, but that outcome is not just, you can't say in response to that, you're quite right, Your Honor, it's not just, but I should win anyway. You can't do it. But you have to say, no, Your Honor, no, it's just not unjust, it's just, and here's why. And you've got to explain it. Justice is an inherent, central part of the law as it's practiced at its best anyway, and when it's practiced well. It's always there. And one of the reasons I don't like debunking things is that people may believe the debunking, including lawyers believe the debunking. And no, we should be actualizing, making real the possibilities we have in what we've inherited.
I guess in equal terms, a fight against the realists who say this is just simply a facade, but also another fight against formalists who say that this is just a pure procedure and it doesn't need to have any life.
Absolutely. Yeah, and for me, what this all goes back to is my own experience of law training. And in fact, when I was a graduate student in English, I decided I didn't want to be a professor of English. And my brother was at the law school, so I went across to the law school and watched a moot court argument about a small piece of Georgia law relating to its sales tax. And what could be less interesting than that, right? But I listened to these people talk, and the arguments on one side, and the arguments on the other, and the materials they were bringing, and the level of thought that they had. This was so far different from my idea of what an argument is, which is sort of the American style, you're wrong, I'm right, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, it isn't like that. This is a way of talking across the lines of difference and making something new. And of course, I might disagree with what they made, but that's okay. I have a way of talking about that disagreement in the future, or in this case.
I wanted to ask you a bit about another important role in your identity, I guess, which is that of a teacher. And I remember as a student of your seminars, one of the most exciting but equally dumbfounding thing was when you assigned us creative exercises. And I remember struggling to respond to those creative exercises. What were you trying to stir in the students? What was behind those assignments?
What behind it is the feeling that in law school in particular, but in lots of educational institutions, people tend to separate off their legal identity from their real identity. That's what they do, and their real life. And then they try to use legal materials and legal modes to just do that. And then now it's 3 o'clock, they can go be themselves. And I think that's a tragedy, and that legal education that permits it is wrong. And so what you should be doing is inviting people constantly to bring into play their other capacities they have for thought and imagination and empathy and anger. I mean, those things, and their own capacity for making new things. Every kid who comes to law school, every single one of them has achieved something which is just phenomenal, which is that they've learned a language. They've learned a language. They've learned their language. Mm-hmm. And they can do it. That must be 98.8% of what they'll ever learn in their entire lives. So when they come to law school, they shouldn't be downtrodden and they shouldn't be afraid. They should be able to say, look, I learned English. I can learn this. And speak as they feel and think about things. So that one thing I sometimes say to students, particularly when they're choosing a job or something like that, is I'll say, well, listen, ask yourself who you were before you came to law school and what you hoped for yourself as a result of it. Those are real things, and keep them alive in yourself. Mm-hmm. And this may lead you to choose a life which, you know, wouldn't grant a lot of prestige or something like that, or which many of your professors would look down on, but which you don't look down on. You should do it. So it's really part of teaching the whole person. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I found those exercises tremendously stimulating at the same time. And I thought that they didn't stop at the moment that you concluded the exercises, but that they remain with you and continue to stimulate your thoughts. That's what I took from those exercises that you're trying to push, right? That you have to continue having those stimulating thoughts.
Right. That's it. This is teaching as a transmission of a disease, right? Yeah.
And you have taught in more departments than one, in many different institutions, but you have taught in addition to law schools, you end up being a professor of English and also you taught in classics. What were those experiences like for you, these changing departments, changing institutional cultures?
Well, it starts with when I was in law school, and I was a friend of mine who ran a large course of a group of TAs in a big course, had somebody jump on him, and he said, well, could I do it? And I had no time to do it, but I said, yes, I will. And so for my last 2 years in law school, I was teaching the Iliad, the Odyssey, plays, Dante, things like that to freshmen. And I loved it. And what I did was to keep alive something in me. This is just what I'm talking about. Even though I was mainly in law school, this was alive. And the same thing was true by my teaching. I taught poetry for 20 years or so. And it was just wonderful to be able to turn from the way I was thinking in my legal or even law and human way to just poetry. And I memorized them. They'd live in my mind. I liked the kind of relationship I could have with the students. It was terrific. I never taught a course in Latin or Greek myself. I did participate in a couple of seminars on law in Greece and things like that. But I felt much the same thing, which is that I have a great reverence, really, for the ancient world and its languages. And I loved having the opportunity to think about those things and think in the ways in which you're invited to do that.
You have already mentioned Alton Becker and the intellectual debt that you had to him. But there was also a group in Michigan, an interdisciplinary group to which you belonged for many years. And could you tell us a little bit about your experience in that interdisciplinary context?
Oh, yeah. That was really wonderful. This was a huge, huge benefit to me. This was a group that met once a month on Monday night. And each time, somebody would present their own work. And the key was, we were almost all in different disciplines. We had a poet, we had an art historian, we had a couple of anthropologists, we had a classicist, an historian, we had a neurologist who had studied the brain. And it turns out, these people were almost all of them, very distinguished. I didn't know that. I mean, I just picked good people. And then after 20 years, you say, these are wonderful people. And the way I thought about this was, I admired all these people a lot. And I felt we had a way of talking together which was trustworthy and real. And so I would write something and I'd give it to them. And they'd be critical of it. But if they thought it was okay, then I said, okay, this is okay. I'm going to publish it. And I don't care what somebody else thinks. And so it gave me that kind of courage. And similarly, really, for almost 20 years, I ran and the Society of Fellows here, which is similarly an interdisciplinary group. The question was completely congenial to me, which is, how can people learn to talk to people who aren't in their field about their work? And how can they learn to listen to people talk about their work who are not in their field? And this was, I think, very successful. And I loved it. I mean, it was just loved it. It was dessert all the time.
there was the practice of translation and talking across languages, across disciplines.
Yes, and it's translation isn't just language either. It's also how you talk, how you carry yourself, what assumptions you make about who your audience is, whether you're asserting this is true, that's true, that's true, and here's why, or whether what you're saying, here's an interesting question. Maybe it's this way, maybe it's that way. It was a little like, we haven't talked about anthropology, but in a way, I was always kind of a wannabe anthropologist. So I would see these people who come from different cultures, and then I'm trying to help them establish a way of talking across mm-hmm. their cultural differences. And in a way, culture may be a better word than language for most people, because language can just be like English or something. But this is the inhabited cultures in which they wanted to get ahead. And in order to get ahead, they had to do this and that. And now, somehow, that's no longer automatic. They have to think about what they're doing in a different way.
So the idea, perhaps, of languages and cultures as what Wittgenstein calls forms of life, entire forms of life and ways of thinking, of arguing, of imagining the world, relationships.
Yes, that's right. Wittgenstein, I have read the Philosophic Investigations, but the only part I've really, really made part of my soul is the very beginning, which I loved. I mean, I just loved. And I said, I don't know, mm-hmm. I don't think I have to read the rest of this. It's such a gift already.
Mm-hmm. We are coming to the end of our conversation today, but I wanted to talk to you or to ask you about your latest book, which I have here, Keep Law mm-hmm. Alive. And among other things, it's perhaps a more pessimistic, perhaps a less hopeful book. It's an indictment, I guess, of current political climate and environment, mostly in the US, but recognizable in other places as well. Are you a bit worried or concerned about the future of law as you have described, as you have practiced it?
Oh, yes. I mean, desperately anxious about this. But what the book does is, as you know, is it tries to capture a sense of what was really good about American law as I learned it. I mean, not that it's always like that, but it was could be really good about it. It's wonderful what its aspirations could be. And then it presents the question, what happens now if we lose it? And when I wrote this, which was over 2 years ago, over a year and a half ago or so, I thought things were very bleak, but I think they're much, much bleaker now. And I think we're really very likely on the edge of a complete collapse of our mm-hmm. country. That's sorry to end on that note, but that's what I thought.
I wanted to avoid ending on that pessimistic note. But if you want to say a few words to our students.
Yeah. One of the questions that I address in this book is, how do we live if we don't have the props that we used to have to live? And my example of that is the 5th century St. Augustine, who lived in worse times than we did. The Roman Empire was falling all around him. The Vandals were besieging his, and he found a way to live, which is based on his religion, but it doesn't have to be a religion. He found a way to live, and part of it was his own self-confidence in his experience, and his own confidence in what he could do with others, and his own willingness to accept his limitations. And with those things, I think it is possible for people to live under very bad terms, and I'm trying to teach myself how to do it.
So I'm going to just say that I really appreciate you having talked with us and with our students and for the time. And again, I'm looking forward to meeting in person again in post-COVID circumstances.
Yes, me too. I'm very glad to have done it. It's really fun to do it. It's wonderful to see you again. And I think we have to have another one of these terrific dinners that we've had recently that couple of years. It's very good wine, right? We'll do that as soon as we can.